Matt's a very good friend of mine, incredibly successful, has got an amazing backstory, has an insane network, and I would say a lot of your success has come off the back of your ability to network, and I've learned a lot from just seeing what you do and being around you. So for everyone here today, Matt has a lot of experience to share, and really grateful for you to share your story and your knowledge.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you for having me. And I have to say, for someone who loves networking so much, I also consider myself pretty antisocial, but Charlie's one of the few people that I love to spend a lot of time with, so thank you for having me here. Also, please forgive my horrendous speaking voice. I was feeling fluey last night, woke up this morning with like daggers in my throat, and but the beauty of Dubai, as anyone who lives or visits here, is you can get whatever you want, whenever you want, and with about 90 minutes later, I had the IV drip. I had the oxygen tank. I'm lying on the couch. I've got the IV drip in my arm. I've got the oxygen tank in my nose. And my young and beautiful girlfriend looks over and thinks, "Fuck, that's what it's like to live with an older man." But I'm much recovered now. So we're going to talk about networking today. As Charlie said, I'm going to tell you about my backstory in a minute. But everything, whilst what happened in my earlier life was never so much planned, and I think I learned a lot more by accident. In hindsight, I put down all my success, or very much most of it, to networking and the people that I've met at various times in my life who've been able to be absolutely instrumental in doing a deal with, in making money with, in introducing me to somebody else. So it's something I'm very excited to talk about. These are the things we're going to talk about today. By the way, I love pink. You're going to get used to that as these slides go on. But I was going to say I don't know why I'm not wearing any, but I do have my pink socks on just to make sure I'm on brand. But we're going to talk about who I am. We're going to talk about the three most important words in networking. We're going to talk about online versus offline networking. One of those that people miss out a lot. We're going to talk about the biggest relationship building mistakes. We're going to talk about the biggest networking mistakes. We're going to talk about the number one reason why people hate networking. We're going to talk about what being a power networker has achieved for me. And we're going to talk about the two very different ways that I network. Just so I get a read on everybody, I mean, who here likes networking? And who here absolutely doesn't like it? Only you. We're going to change that by the end of this. And who thinks they're any good at it? Okay. First of all, I think when it comes to networking, one of the big things that people miss out is who needs to network. And I think a lot of the time people think, oh, I need to network for a purpose. You know, maybe I'm looking for a job. Maybe I'm looking for a hire. Maybe I'm trying to do a deal. But you know, for me, networking is, it's almost part of, well, it's not almost, it's 100% part of my life, and it should be very much part of everybody's life if you want to be successful. You know, whether you're an employee, whether you're an employer, whether you're already well known, you know, whether you're an influencer, whether you want to do something right now, or whether you think you may want to do something in the future, doing the networking itself has to become a big part of your life. So listen, we're just going to backtrack into my story for a little bit. James was talking about being the oldest person in the room, but I think he's making me feel old now. I mean, I'm 43 now, but my backstory goes back to late 80s, early 90s, and I always wanted to be in business. I didn't particularly know why. Well, I think the only real reason at the time was in the late 80s and early 90s, the only way we thought we were told to make money was to own your own business. And I very much wanted to make money. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to make a load of money. I also thought I wanted to work in musical theatre and be Danny Zuko. But when I realised my singing voice wouldn't hold up, I did have to revert back to wanting to go into business. Now, my father, he had his own business. He has, you know, a very successful business, very different to anything I do. And it was nothing that I was ever involved in. But I think, obviously being around that entrepreneurial background and, you know, watching him bring staff home from work and going on work dinners, work trips, you know, watching trainings and stuff, obviously rubbed off on me in some way. And I spent my teenage years trying to do everything possible to make money. You know, I again showing my age, but if anyone remembers the UK in the kind of early 90s and mid 90s, we used to have a magazine called The Exchange and Mart. I'm sure there's online equivalents of it now, but this magazine, The Exchange and Mart, used to sell all kinds of crap. But then in the back of it, there was. There was always business opportunities for sale. I said, you know, business opportunities, you know, various different Ponzi schemes where you could send off a stamped addressed envelope, you know, to be able to receive for 20 quid the secret, to be able to send another stamped addressed envelope to ask someone else to send you 20 quid and all these things. And I used to buy and look for everything because I had no idea how to do anything or what I wanted to do, but I was just very, very hungry. And I'd go to the markets, I'd buy and sell every product I could get my hands on, from, you know, Tamagotchi pets to blow up sofas, blow up cushions, and everything in between. And by the time I got to 18, I'd done my A levels. I was leaving school. And I didn't want to go to uni. My parents, particularly my mother, very much wanted me to go to university, because again, back in the late 90s, it was still that kind of era where if you didn't go to university, you were kind of thought of as a failure to your parents, you know, particularly if you'd been in private education, and also, you know, to get any kind of job in a corporate environment or in, I guess, a respectable employer, you needed to have university on your CV. I didn't want to go. I was convinced that it was just going to hold me back 3 years because I was going to go off and run my own business. And I managed to convince my parents to let me go to university and work in a business alongside at the same time. And my daddy just sold his business at this point, well, a year or so before. He wasn't really doing anything, and he'd invested in a corporate clothing company at the time. It was a family business, not my family's business, but it was a family business that made uniforms, career wear, so clothes for security guards, for bus drivers, for nurses. And it was theoretically a very successful business, which had come into a short-term cash flow difficulty, and my dad could make a small investment, and, you know, they'd be able to get back to trading again. So I convinced them to let me work in there in sales whilst going to uni at the same time. Now, all of my friends who went to uni, you know, back in the day, they'd have probably 6 hours a week of stuff to do. They'd have, like, you know, one little book to read, 6 hours of lectures to do. I thought, well, that's going to leave me plenty of time to work. I was doing a business and accountancy degree, and I walk in on the first day, and I just get given these stacks and stacks and stacks of books and lectures that were going to take 30 plus hours a week. And there was no way I'd have been able to do the uni and be able to do the work as well. So I kind of begged and grovelled and said, "Please, please let me leave uni. I'm going to I want to work in this business. I'm going to spend a year at doing my best with it, and hopefully by then everything will have worked out. If it doesn't, I'll go back to uni, and we can just consider it a gap year, and I'll be no worse off than a lot of my friends who'd taken a gap year at the time." So off I went, and that's what I did. And this business, we found out very quickly that it was an absolute dog's dinner. It had been trading for 40, 50 years, but in the state it was now, the customers were leaving, the suppliers wouldn't supply, the family members were, you know, incompetent, verging on fraudulent, and the whole thing was falling to pieces. My dad had ended up putting in 15 to 20 times the amount of investment that he'd originally planned to do. But he wasn't doing anything with his business. Yeah, he was sat at home, and not because he was being lazy, but, you know, he kind of had enough from the stresses of the work he'd done. And I was obviously young and hungry, and also getting pissed off with the fact that I go into work every day and see that effectively my dad's money was getting squandered by these people who were taking the piss. I used to come home to dinner every night to be banging my hands on the table saying, "Come on, you know, please, please come into work and do something about this." And eventually, my dad turned around and he said, "Look, I've had 25 years of business. I've had 30 years of your mother." He goes, I'm just not interested." He goes, I'm too tired now." He goes, "But you go and do something with it. You know, you can't make it any worse than they've made it. So off you go." And I went in the next day and I fired literally everybody. Everybody apart from this little old guy who worked in the warehouse. And we kind of rewound and went back to zero and started this business from scratch. Now, I knew nothing. I mean, I obviously at the time I thought I knew everything because I'd spent the previous few years reading every kind of business book or periodical I could get my hands on. And again, show my age there, because back in those days, with the email was just starting. There was certainly no social media, and any of the information that I get was from was from big thick hardback books. But I thought I knew everything, and off I went. And I spent the next 3 years really having the biggest learning curve that I think I could have possibly have asked for in business. I had to learn how to recruit the staff. I had to learn how to decide what products we were going to supply, how to do sales, how to do marketing, how to do finance. I had to deal with suppliers who didn't want to supply to us. I had to apologize to customers, who didn't really want to deal with us. And ultimately, we found our feet. We went from supplying a small number of very big customers to a large number of very small customers. Removing the reliance on any one particular customer, and I took the business from when I started losing about £300,000 a year, and in its third year making about £30,000. Now these numbers, even in those days, not big numbers by any stretch. But really, what was important for me was the was that turnaround, was that learning experience that, money aside, I got to experience pretty much every problem, or at the time what I thought was pretty much every problem a business owner could ask for. I'm sure you guys are very into your mentors and learning from people who've made the mistakes so that you don't have to. And back in those days, I guess I hadn't had the experience, so I got to make the mistakes. And I made 3 years of very painful, very expensive mistakes, which ultimately took me to kind of 21, 22. And, I felt I was ready to move on to something else, not because I'd achieved great success there, but just because I was also bored. I think at that point I was starting to learn that as much as it was important to find something that I could learn from and make money from, if I was really going to be successful in something, I would have to love what I did. And I always felt as a younger guy that I wanted to work in bars and clubs and pubs. Not because I had any experience, but as I'm sure some of you guys can attest to, as a young guy, we always think, if I own a bar, I can make loads of money, drink loads of beer and meet loads of girls. I didn't really think there was much more of a business model to it than that, but that's what I went off to do. And a year or so prior, I'd been in Boston in the States. I'd been taken on a networking trip, something that we'll come on to talk about soon. But I didn't particularly appreciate what it was at the time. But our bank, they'd taken kind of 10 or 12 of their local customers over to America. Somewhat like these kind of masterminds. There was 3 days of events. You get to sit down with let's say world class trainers, world class speakers, but also more importantly, get to network with a lot of other local business owners. And it wasn't just a kind of 10 or 12 people from my bank. It was other regions, and there was 40 or 50 people there. And I'd met a guy who was in leisure himself. He was in bars and clubs. And we kept in touch. And when I decided I wanted to go and do my own bars and clubs, I contacted him, and he said, I've got just the right pub for you. It's one of mine. It's a great unit, but I just don't want it anymore. I'll let you take it on for free." And obviously, alarm bells should have been ringing, but at the time I thought, what a lovely guy doing me such a nice favour. And I went in and took over this horrendous community pub where the local gangsters used to leave their machetes and their guns on the tables before they went up to the bar to order their drinks. But what I did learn from this guy was more business tricks that I didn't know before. And he used to teach me about cash flow and the importance of having a business model where you were getting paid by your customers before you were paying your suppliers. And over the next year or so, he taught me to buy a few pubs where we'd effectively go in on a Friday night, write a check. Again, we don't have checks anymore, but write a check to buy the pub and to buy the stock, and hopefully we could trade the arse off this pub over the next 3 or 4 days to turn that stock into cash, and the check would clear on Monday, and fingers crossed everything would be okay. So I had these pubs for a few years, sorry, for a year or so, a few pubs. But they weren't, you know, some were okay, some were not okay, but overall I wasn't really making any money. And I knew I needed to do something else. I needed to have some other kind of income stream that I could have, not just selling alcohol. You know, whether that was door money, whether it was selling food, whether it was promoters in there, but I needed something other than just selling alcohol. Now, in my personal life, I'd started to visit the local strip club, and on my nights off from my bars, I used to spend the nights in there, hanging out with the local manager and wasting what little money I had at the time behind the bar at the strip club. And I decided, well, because I know the manager, because I know the girls, I therefore understand the business model, and that qualifies me to be able to go and open my own strip club. We went to look for a venue to open, and we found a place in Wakefield, and I found this freehold building. It was about £360,000. And at this point, I had 100, 120 grand to my name from a couple of houses that I'd flipped and from some of the trading of these pubs. And I went into the local HSBC. Again, you know, this certainly doesn't happen in England anymore, but I met this local bank manager, a guy called Andrew Bennett, who had his own local discretion. And back in these days, you know, the guys could sign off their own loans without having to go up to credit, you know, just as long as it fit in some kind of, you know, broad boundaries and broad criteria. And this guy was allowed to sign off up to £1 million. And he said to me that basically if I put 100 grand deposit down, he'd give me a mortgage on the building. And then when I'd fitted out the building, he would then allow me to refinance it at its higher value and give me another loan of 600 or 700 grand. So I thought, fantastic, this is what I need. I can go and open my bar. So I put down, like I say, circa 100 grand, and I went to go and find a contractor. And this is obviously where the problems start, and I'm not advocating anyone does this for 1 minute, but these were the guerrilla tactics we had to use at the time. I found a contractor, and it was looking like a £300,000 refit. It was a problem because I only had 20 grand left. So I sat down with this contractor. We agreed a payment plan that started with 20 grand for the first week and various other monies for the rest of it. Gave him his 20 grand, and off he went. Started the fit out, managed to dodge his calls for the next 2 or 3 weeks as the next weekly payment's due, and the next weekly payment's due, and by the time he's kind of fitted this unit out to 30-odd%, and I'm still only in for 20 grand, we sat down and I said, look, awkward conversation, but I haven't got any more money. However, what I have got is a mortgage offer to be able to refinance this building when it's fitted out at its higher valuation. So I know you're going to hate me, but if you can sit this out and finish the unit off, then I'll pay you some extra money at the end. I'll pay you some penalties. I said, you know, we can fall out now and you're going to be fucked and I'm going to be fucked, or we can both make some money at the end of this. And luckily, I'm sure he doesn't like me any more to this day than he did back then, but he agreed. He had no choice but to see it through. And off he went, finished the unit. My local bank manager was true to his word. He refinanced it for me. I paid this contractor off, who was slightly happier than 12 weeks earlier. And the first bar opened. And it was pretty much a success from the outset. And, you know, I always say it was right place at the right time. I mean, I do obviously believe we had a model that I thought was going to be very different, and we were going to bring, as I say, a professional and, let's say, genuine business attitude and genuine business principles to an industry that was obviously completely shunned and normally run by, you know, by gangsters or rich people's playthings. But it was also, you know, a bit of the right place at the right time. Spearmint Rhino was starting to become quite prevalent in England, and they were spending big money on marketing. Stringfellows were still pretty popular, and I was 24 at the time, so it was a good story for the local press. And you know, we hit the ground running, and the Wakefield bar did very well. Ran that for maybe 6 months, and I got the opportunity to buy another local strip club, actually a Spearmint Rhino in Harrogate that hadn't been performing very well. I knew why it wasn't performing very well. It wasn't that it wasn't taking money, because I used to visit this place. It wasn't that it wasn't taking it. It was that everybody who worked there was robbing it in some way. You know, the doorman had his hand in the till, the bar staff had his hand in the till, the DJs had their hand in the till. And I thought, well, all I need to do is take over it, fire all these people, and everything will be tickety-boo. But I had no money to go and do it. I got it from my bank manager, who at this point couldn't give me any more money. He introduces me to a local finance broker. I mean, I knew nothing about finance then, absolutely nothing. And this guy told me that he could do a refinance on my air conditioning units for me. He said, you've bought these air conditioning units for 30 grand. He goes, all you need to do is sign this paperwork, and basically what it means is I now own your air conditioning. You're going to rent it back off me for the next 3 years, and I'm going to put 30 grand in your bank. I signed the paper, he gives me the 30 grand, and I don't think I really understood what happened other than the fact I had 30 grand in my bank. I thought, well, what else can I go and find in this bar to refinance as well? So over the next few weeks, I'm refinancing air conditioning units, fridge freezers, toilets, you know, anything I can get my hands on to generate 200, 300 grand to go off and buy this Spearmint Rhino. Bought it. And by that point, I was hooked. It was 2005, 2006. The finance companies were giving out money like it was going out of fashion. I decided I'd become the world's best borrower. They wanted to lend, I wanted to borrow. And over the next 3 or 4 years, I opened 11 strip clubs, 50 or 60 bars and pubs, a hotel, restaurants, juice bars, property portfolio. And by 2008, had a very large eight-figure business. I felt like I looked like an absolute baller, but in reality, it was all built on a bed of sand and a deck of cards, and was completely over-leveraged, was completely disorganized, and was heading for a disaster. Didn't really appreciate it at the time. Well, so didn't appreciate it at the time at all, because you don't know what you don't know. And I thought, well, we can get into the next month, because when you've only been through the first part of a cycle, you don't know what's on the other end. And when you only know that for the last 4 or 5 years everybody wants to lend you money, you think, well, they're going to keep lending you money for the next 4 or 5 years. And every time we got to a problem at the end of the month, the lenders a bit more and lenders a bit more, and the wheels just seemed to keep turning until they didn't. And in the beginning of probably June-ish of 2008, the credit crunch had started to kick in. All the liquidity in the markets had dried up, and our lenders turned around and said, we can't lend to you anymore. I then had to have some awkward conversations with them to say, well, if you can't lend anymore, we have a problem. I need to renegotiate my loans with you. Never asked anyone to take a haircut, but basically said, look, I can't pay you over 2 years or 3 years, so I need 7 years or 10 years, or whatever we needed to make this work. Some people said yes, some people said no, but ultimately not enough people said yes. And in the space of literally 6 or 8 weeks, and that really is how quick it happens. I mean, if I tell you the 1st of June 2008, my Experian credit rating, which I'm sure you all know, was 999, my mortgages were fine, my credit was perfect. 8 weeks later, the first business had gone into administration. Everything was cross-company guaranteed, so it pulled all the other businesses down. I personally guaranteed everything, so it pulled me down. And literally within the space of 8 weeks, I filed for personal bankruptcy, which at the time was for 45 million quid, the biggest personal bankruptcy outside of London at the time. And I was told that my life was now in tatters, and I'd never be able to work again. I'd never have any credibility again. I had a one-year-old daughter, an ex-wife at the time, and wasn't really sure what was going to happen next, other than the fact that I had to do something. And, I tell this story, and I talk on a few podcasts and things, and people always kind of want to dig deep into the mindset of the bankruptcy and the comeback and that kind of thing. And I always say that I actually don't really have, let's say, an exciting story to tell about how I went from losing it all to then coming back again. Because ultimately for me, I can say, I could have sat at home, watching a bit of Jeremy Kyle and blaming everyone else for my own mistakes. Or I could have gone back out to work again. And like I said, I had a one-year-old daughter who needed feeding, a missus who needed a roof over her head. And I always say that I was never born to be poor, so I was never going to get paid being sat on the couch. And I went out the next day and really got back to work again. Because I think one of the things that I always get asked as well is, what does it feel like to lose everything? And It wasn't until, at the time, I used to, if you'd have asked me back in 2008, 2009, I'd tell a lot more of a, let's say, a financial answer to that question. If you ask me now I realise what's happened, I always say, well, I actually didn't lose anything. All I lost was my money. I didn't lose my contacts, my knowledge, my skill set, you know, my experience. And if anything, I've come out of it with more experience than I had when I went in, because I've now been through something else that most people don't get to go through, and I've added to my experience. And you know, there's that old expression of the fact that, you know, your first millions is your hardest million, and you know, the more you make thereafter, the easier it becomes. I think that analogy kind of fit in very well with the story for me then, because, you know, yes, it had taken a few years to make decent money in my earlier days, but as horrific as my life and situation looked on paper at the end of 2008, it was very easy for me to get back into the game and very quick for me to start making money again, because I had the contacts, I had the ideas, I had the experience, and you know, I had the people to deal with. I decided I needed a bit of a change from leisure. You know, I'd always worked kind of all night in the bars, all day in the office. I was pretty exhausted from it all. And back in 2006, I'd started a finance company, more of a broker than a lender. It was a bit by accident, because I'd spent so much time borrowing from all of these lenders that I decided that I kind of learned to be a lender by being a borrower. And I got a fantastic network of weird and wonderful lenders that, you know, that no one had really ever heard of. I had a lot of contacts in the local business space, and whenever any of my peers or friends were short of some money on a deal, they'd come to me. I'd, you know, match them up with one of these lenders and take a commission. So when I started back in kind of 2008, the end of 2008, the beginning of 2009, I came back as a finance broker. Went from being a broker to a lender. One of my old investors kind of came back, and as much as some people were very pissed off with me for the money that they lost at the time, most of them realised that I'd never set out to do anything malicious. It was, you know, a case of, I guess, greed on all our parts, and naivety and stupidity. One of them came back, offered to back me to go and start a lending book. And from, if we condensed 10 years from 2012, 2013 to now, I've taken my experience from being a borrower to be a lender, taken my experience from being a business owner to be an advisor, and built a lending book, which is where now we specialise in lending to UK businesses, normally secured against some kind of asset, but always dealing in some kind of situation where other people or other lenders don't want to lend to that business, because, you know, not because it's a bad credit, not because it's a bad risk, but because there's something that they just don't understand about it. And, you know, we can approach it with, you know, with my experience of, I always say, whatever problems you think that business has been through, believe me, I've had 500 times more, and I've come out to tell the tale on the other end. So as long as you're honest with me about your situation, I'm sure we can find an answer. And invariably, many of the businesses that we deal with don't even need money, or certainly don't need as much money as they think they would need. They need support, they need advice, and they, you know, they need help in a situation where they've never been in that situation, and they'll probably never, you know, they won't know many other people who've been in that situation, but I get to help. And in the last few, well, in the last 10 years, I've lent over 500 million quid to UK businesses, raised over 100 million from our investor network of high net worths. And now my core business consists of two different lending entities. I lend to law firms on litigation finance. I lend to all other kind of businesses in the UK, as long as it's secured. I've got a chain of bars and clubs, again, by accident. I swore I'd stay out of that game, but got dragged back in. An e-commerce business selling ladies' shoes and handbags. Not a fetish, just something that I accidentally got involved with. And I have a banking platform too. So these are all the things that keep me busy. But I guess, as I said at the beginning, at the heart of getting all of these businesses, at the heart of all my success, has always been down to my network. And I've talked a lot about networking before. Like I said, I go on podcasts, or, you know, I'll answer questions, but I've never really, this is the first time I'm kind of doing this talk, I've never really had to sit down and analyze everything that I think is strategic for networking for me, everything that I think people do right, everything that people do wrong. And I have a newsletter, a little plug, you can find that on my website at matt-haycox.com, but I have a newsletter which I write every week. So for the last 3 weeks, I've been writing about networking mistakes, relationship building mistakes, and everything in between, to try and make sure I've got enough fodder to tell you all of my top tips today. So, what is the number one reason people hate networking? It's a very divisive topic, networking. For something so innocuous, you know, particularly in the business environment where it's so essential, you get so many people that, you know, at best roll their eyes, and, you know, at worst come out in hives and hot sweats when we talk about networking. I think ultimately, the number one reason why people hate networking is because they're doing it wrong. We have to watch this little slide out just for my entertainment. So, when you look at most networking, particularly in the UK, I know you guys are at the upper echelons of I'm going to have to move this on. You're going to be distracted. No, you're not going to listen to a word I'm saying, are you? There you go. Networking in the UK particularly is very much, you know, people go to a BNI business breakfast, you know, you're forced to go in there, you've got to pay your 10 quid to sit down and eat a crusty croissant, and you're told to take a contact, and you've got to force some transactional activity, and people feel pressure, they don't know what they're going to say, or they're shy, or, you know, whatever it may be. And when you look at networking like that, then no wonder people hate it, because it's just not an enjoyable activity, it's not fun to do, and it doesn't generate any returns either. Now, if I told you what networking looks like for me, that's when I used to be thinner, I host weekly dinners for CEOs and investors on my boat. At top right, JP was a guest there with me. I had a villa in Ibiza with, you know, 20 or 30 business owners, CEOs, investors, high net worth people over a summer on time. Bottom left, I have an event in the UK that I've been putting on for the last 5 years, where over 3 days I have 250 to 300 high net worth individuals. Every day we were sponsored by people like Patek Philippe, St. James's Place, NetJets, etc. And the bottom right, that's my little Dubai football club. And to me, all of these things that, you know, most people might look at and say, well, that's just Matt on the piss, or Matt kicking a ball around with his friends. This, for me, is networking. And because all of those are super fun activities, that is why, if you're doing it right, how can anyone ever hate networking? But if you're being forced to go down to an event you don't want to go to a breakfast you don't want to attend, then of course you're going to hate it. So, 8 biggest networking mistakes. First of all, very easy one, not networking. I can go on and on and on about this, but I spend 40% of my time, literally I spend 40% of my time networking in some way, shape or form. Whether that is meeting people, new people, whether it's developing relationships with people I've already got. But, you know, I've done that now accidentally in my earlier years, and now in my later years, as a core part of my business strategy, and also just my general life strategy. And you know, for me, it doesn't matter where you are in your business, whether you're trying to build it up, whether you've already got a great business, that there should never be a point when you stop networking, because there's always more people to meet, there's always more relationships to build, and there's always more relationships to nurture. So there should never, ever be a reason not to network. And everyone's got their excuses, you know, it's because they're shy, they don't like talking to people, they haven't got time because they're too busy working, or whatever it may be, but you absolutely cannot neglect networking. Number two, thinking that networking is solely transactional. This kind of goes back to my BNI breakfast type analogy. For me, the networking should really, the clue is in the word, that it's actually at this point, it's just networking. You know, you're networking, then you're relationship building, and then maybe some transactions are going to happen. But if you're always going out to always force some kind of transactional event, then you're going to be sorely disappointed. You're not going to build deeper, meaningful connections. You're going to push people away. yes, there's always times where there's a transaction ready to happen there and then, you know, just by, you know, by luck or by, you know, by some serendipitous, you know, course of events, somebody wants to buy what you're selling, or you can connect in some way. But I always think you've got to look at that as the absolute exception and really consider that that networking is a long-term growth of relationships and an activity that you'll never stop doing. That some of these people you will transact with, most you probably will never transact with, but just by having them in your network, you know, one leads to the two leads to three, and transactions somehow will come further down the line. Number three, forgetting the follow-up. Forgetting the follow-up. It's all very well and good when you go to these events. You know, here's a prime example, you know, 150 of you guys in this room, you'll all have made some good connections over the last few days. But it's all very easy. You get back on the plane to England or you go back to your lives in Dubai and you forget each other. And you either forget each other and never remember you again, or you forget each other until you want to remember them, by which point it's too far down the line and you've missed out a big gap of time that you could have been bonding and furthering that relationship. I have a personal strategy. It's not rocket science, but when I meet people I know that I want to follow up with them, I know I want to have them in my contact base. I don't put them in my contacts. I always put them in my notes, because then I'll remember. If I put them in my contacts, I'll just get lost and forgotten. But I put them in my notes. The next day, I'll sit down and the kind of two or three people I've met the day before, or the 20 people at an event that I've met, I'll then add them into my contacts whilst, you know, reaching out to them on WhatsApp, on email, or however it's going to be, to remind them about me, to remind them, maybe jog the memory with a funny anecdote that happened in the event, or just something to keep them in my mind. Last year I went to Amsterdam on a banking convention, probably met 100 people at this event that I needed to keep up with afterwards. It was a three-day event, didn't really have much time to do any following up while I was there. But on the flight back from Amsterdam to Dubai, spent 6 hours literally individually emailing every single one of these people with a personalised message, personalised anecdote, and personalised reason of why we should be keeping in touch and doing business in the future. If I hadn't have done that, I guarantee you, none of them are going to remember me. As much as I like to think I'm very memorable, none of them are going to remember me. And I'm probably going to forget the ones that I want to contact with as well. So everything is in the follow-up. Neglecting online networking. So I know, I'm sure in Charlie's mastermind, you'll do a lot of talk about social media and selling online and follower growth and that kind of thing. That is not my area of expertise in the slightest. But what I do love social media for is the ability to have direct access to people that you want to connect with. Now, everyone's going to have their own favoured platforms, you know, ways of doing it, their own tools. I mean, I'm a massive LinkedIn user. And I mean, I guess it probably depends what sectors you're in. And by the way, I should have said earlier, I'll caveat this whole talk by the fact that everything I do is really, really revolves around trying to connect and build relationships, ultimately with high net worth individuals, with potential investors, you know, with people I can extract cash from to invest in my businesses. I know for you guys, a lot of you all want to connect with different kinds of people, but you know, all of these strategies apply across the board, but they might need a little finesse for what it is that you want to do. But online networking is as important as offline networking, and it's just a fantastic opportunity to meet people. I met a guy from a random connection, I met a guy that I'd found on LinkedIn and to do cold outreach to try and build a relationship with, that over a 7 or 8 year period, I ultimately made over 10 million quid from. And that is a guy that I cold outreached out to. He ignored me. I chased him. I actually sent him a message saying, "You're going to fucking reply to me or what?" And he actually did. And we, within a week of that first meeting, we started a relationship which went on to be very fruitful. And we still do business together today. So, LinkedIn, Instagram, however you do it, use those tools to try and reach out to the people that you want to connect with. Number five, ignoring, sorry, my voice is waning. Ignoring the power of diverse connections. Another mistake I see a lot of people making when it comes to networking is only wanting to connect with people that they see as directly relevant and directly transactional to the, you know, to the business in question. So, you know, if you're selling computer systems, then you're trying to network with somebody who they think they can sell that computer to, and ignoring everybody completely outside of that. And going back to, I guess, my example of high net worth individuals and investors that I'm trying to look to meet with, I could, if I kept my focus purely on wealthy investors, then it's going to be quite a narrow focus. But if you take the viewpoint, which obviously is what I subscribe to and know is true, that networking is a long-term game, it's networking to relationship building, to, you know, to playing a game that never ends, then you should want as many and varied and diverse connections in there as possible. And if I look at my network now, yes, there's, you know, business owners and CEOs and investors, but there's politicians or celebrities or entertainers, or, you know, all different kinds of people from all different mix, that you may immediately say, well, you know, what relevance is that to the business that you're doing? First of all, I'm not being that mercenary about it. I'm trying to build a relationship with someone that I think is a great person anyway. But secondly, I know that if they're a cool person, they're going to have other cool people in their network, and that, you know, that will, and by me knowing them, they're ultimately going to introduce me at some point to someone else. And, you know, case in point, 4 or 5 weeks ago, a friend of mine, a, you know, famous singer who ultimately is completely unrelated to my business whatsoever, was here in Dubai. He invited me out to a dinner with a friend of his who I'd never met. He goes, oh, you know, you guys are like each other, you should meet. Within an hour of meeting this guy at dinner, we're talking about the potential of a 7-figure investment. Since then, I've met up with him in England, and he's already started to introduce me to some contacts of his. And, you know, for me, it's about having that open mind to where everything can lead to, and not just, you know, not just pigeonholing people in certain categories. Number six, networking mistake: not keeping detailed records. This kind of ties in almost with having your strategy for the not following up. Yeah, I don't mean you need to have a very fancy Rolodex that's locked away in a safe, but you need to be able to categorise your contacts in some way to make sure that you've got as many detailed, many bits of detail and bits of information for them as possible. You know, whether that's birthdays or wife's names or kids' favourite meals. You know, depending on the, we'll talk about relationship building later, but depending on the level of relationship building you're going to be doing, all of this helps. Even from a simplistic perspective, not only have you got the telephone number, have you got their second telephone number, have you got their social media contacts, have you got their email, you know, have you got other ways to make sure you can get hold of them? Because in the early days, yeah, before the relationship's built, and you might just need to be reaching out to these people and you're relentlessly getting them, if you can't get hold of them by one method of contact, you need to be getting hold of them by another method of contact. Number seven, not meeting enough people at events. You know, it's very easy when you go to these big networking events, or not just networking events, but when you go to, let's say you go to an event like this, and there's hundreds, you know, 100 plus great people in the room. You're going to meet someone you like, probably. You sat on your table now. You sat on your table on the first day, or you sat next to them in the buffet or whatever, and you start talking, and you get a bond with each other, and you ignore everyone else for the next 2 days. And you've missed out on the chance to have, you know, to kind of get to know and hang out with 95 other people plus in the room. And there's obviously a fine balance between not being rude and having enough conversation. But for me, when you're in an event where there's many, many, many people there, you need to use that opportunity to meet as many of them as possible, and then go deep on the follow-up later on. An example, I host a dinner on a Thursday night here. I have 10, 12 people on there. At 10 or 12 people, it's very difficult to go deep, never mind in a room like this with 100 people, or in a networking event with 300 people. And you know, my personal strategy will be to have a 10 or 15 minute conversation with all of those 10 or 12 people. I'll immediately know that, you know, that guy, he's going to be really good for me, actually. That guy, they're going to be really good for me. And I'll make sure that I know to go deep with them, you know, whether it's the next day, the next week. But I don't make the mistake of getting caught into one person and one relationship and waking up the next day thinking, fuck, I didn't speak to those other nine people. You know, was there someone interesting or good for me there? So really use the opportunity in these events to meet as many people as possible and see, you know, you'll find very quickly if you've got synergies, whether that's work synergies, whether it's personality synergies, and, you know, you just want to hang out with them later, and then use the time afterwards for the going deep and for the follow-up. And this little funny character says, are we having fun yet? Because a big mistake people make, another big mistake when people are networking is not having fun. And tied it at the beginning with, you know, why do people not like it? They don't like it because they're not doing it properly. If you're not having fun, then you're not doing it properly either. Well, I've told you about some of the things that I do for, you know, that I do for networking. They may be different to you, it may be different for you based on sector or budget or interests or whatever else. But ultimately, networking is about meeting great people and building great relationships. So it should only be fun. Again, this is very relevant to me. You might need to make some tweaks to this for yourself. But when I network, I'm looking to network with three different kinds of people. Cash on the left. I'm looking to meet people who are potential investors, people I could transact with either now or at some point in the future. Secondly, I'm looking to network with people who can lead me to other people further down the line. And thirdly, with the kind of having a diverse network, I'm looking to just to network with great people, you know, just people that I know that are going to enrich my life in some way, shape or form. With, again, taking away that immediate transactional expectation, great people lead to great things. You know, great people lead to other great people who will lead to great things. So I'll obviously prioritize the amount of time I spend on each of those different things, or I'll use a different strategy with each ones. But for me, they are the three types of people that I look to network with. And for all of you in all of your individual businesses, you'll be able to tweak that slightly, but I think the split should be the same across the board. Now, when it comes to networking, there's two different ways that I do it, on a general basis and on a focused basis. So for me, general networking is where I haven't got one person in mind, you know, one specific person that I'm looking to build to meet or to build a relationship with. I'm just looking to put myself around interesting people, wealthy people, great people. And there'll be different ways. You know, that could be coming to an event like this. It could be going to a charity dinner. It could be, you know, being invited to a fancy event. You know, there's not one particular person in there where I know that there's going to be something to transact or someone to build with, but I know that in an environment like that, there's going to be great people. And focused networking is where I know I need to meet that person because that person, I have got a specific thing that I can do with them, a business deal, an investment, a loan, whatever it may be. But it's, you know, it's not general. It's completely focused on meeting one person. So a few networking super hacks. And again, these are relevant to the kind of people I want to meet. But what is absolutely essential if you want to meet great people is you've got to be in the room with them. If you're not in the room, then you're never going to meet them. So for me, joining high-end trips, you know, the value I get from that is unbelievable. And no matter what those trips cost, they always pay for themselves either immediately or in the long run. I got back last week from a skiing trip to St. Moritz. It was an American Express Black Card trip where they had arranged, you know, 4 or 5 days in St. Moritz to stay in a great hotel, to visit the snow polo, to go to a Michelin star dinner, and ultimately anyone who was going to be on that trip was another American Express Black Card holder. Yes, there's an investment involved, and we'll talk about that later on. But if you want to do great networking, if you want to build the opportunity to see people, you're going to have to invest. There's going to be upfront costs, whether it's time or whether it's money. This doesn't happen by magic, and there's going to be an investment. But paying to be on that trip, paying to be around those kind of people, I know that, okay, This is general networking, not focused networking, because I don't know who's going to be on the trip, but I do know that there's going to be other people there who are wealthy, who are successful, who are going to an event like that, and it's putting me in the room with them. Be an arranger. This is one that costs nothing. Arranging events, arranging to put people together, being a connector, being an arranger is a fantastic networking super hack. I've mentioned earlier that I do a dinner on my boat here every week where I'll host various high net worths, various business people, and I always get them to bring a plus one along as well. So as well as me bonding with the people that I want to spend time with, they bring people that I then get to meet as well. And you know, if I look across this, I've probably done it 20 weeks or something in the last 40 weeks. For those 200 plus people, there's only a small number of those people I can realistically transact with, but there's, you know, 180, 190 other people who could all probably be transacting with each other. There's been people on those trips that I've put together that have met each other by accident, who've gone on to do business with each other, and what they always remember is that Matt put them together. And you know, it's another great way of networking, of building relationships, and of impressing people to further that relationship. Just like joining high-end trips, staying in five-star hotels, flying business class, joining clubs where there are going to be other wealthy people. In terms of non-specific things, when it comes to networking, very, very important to be memorable. I told you I like pink. That's me and my pink flamingo. I forget what the bias is called, but I actually read about this in a book recently. I actually just genuinely like pink. Otherwise, I wouldn't wear it. I wouldn't have stuff. But again, yeah, when it comes to people who didn't know me and they then meet me, Matt with the pink boat, Matt with the pink clothes, Matt with the pink everything is a very very easy to remember Matt. If it's not being memorable, having a talking point, whether that's something for you to talk to other people about, for them to talk to you about, having a trick, having a skill. And when it comes to, let's say, struggling with confidence or not enjoying being in an environment with other people, I think being funny, and this doesn't mean being a stand-up comedian, but just being generally amusing. I think if you try and think of anybody who is funny, you probably can't think of a funny person that you don't like, because we're just naturally programmed to like funny people. And it's just, a fantastic hack, icebreaker, whatever you want to call it, that helps with building networking relationships. So when it comes to the focus networking, my four-step process here is, first of all, I go and find out exactly who I want to target. So using that example I gave you a minute ago about the guy who I ultimately did, you know, 10 million quid of the business with, at the time I was trying to work with peer-to-peer lending businesses. You know, this is mid 2015 or something, 2015, 2016 in the UK. I'd just done a deal with a peer-to-peer lending company. I therefore knew that other peer-to-peer lending companies would be good for me to do business with. So I went out and found the 7 or 8 companies in the UK, the CEOs or the owners of those companies, and then found a way to try and contact with them, to try and get in touch with them, which invariably was with LinkedIn at the time. So find your target, focus on it. Secondly, I like to then control the situation and control the environment. Again, you know, when it comes to wanting people to remember you, wanting to build great relationships, wanting to get what you want out of a situation, you know, that comes from having that control over it. You know, be the organizer, you know, be in some kind of way that you've got control. Now again, invariably, that probably, you know, to control something, you probably have to pay for it, but networking is an investment. Number three, I invest. Hopefully you don't recklessly throw money away like a rapper, but invest in networking. Again, I'll give you another example. 4 or 5 years ago, I was at the 40th birthday party of the wife of a wealthy friend in London, I was sat next to a guy at the time who was a financial advisor based in an offshore jurisdiction, and he raises money for a comparable business to mine. He'd been pumping tens of millions of pounds into a business that was very directly similar to mine. I knew that if I could build a relationship with this guy, I would be able to get money from him. We had a good chat at the dinner. He said, look, I obviously know your business model, like you, but I'm not going to do anything with you because, you know, what I already do isn't broken, so there's nothing to fix. But, you know, nice to meet you. You know, I'm sure we can keep in touch. Now, I knew it may not happen tomorrow, it may not be next month, it may not be next week, it may not even be next year, but I knew there would be a point in time that I could get this guy to do some business with me. And he lives in the Cayman Islands, and he'd fly into England probably every 3 months. And every time he flew into England, I'd make sure that I got him to take him out for dinner. And he liked fancy things, this guy. You know, he was a bit of a gambler. He liked his wine, he liked his food. And I'd always take him out to some nice places in London. You know, I'm controlling the environment, I'm investing. And I'd spend decent money on this. And so this probably went on for 14 months, 15 months. And people that knew what I was doing with this guy were saying, you're fucking crazy. You know, you must be 30, 40, 50 grand deep into entertaining some guy that won't do any business with you. And I said, he will do business with me. It might not be tomorrow, but he will do business with me. And 14 months later, this guy rings me up. He goes, oh, you know, the company that I normally deal with, they fucked up on something. I wouldn't mind trying you out on a deal. And we did a little deal together, which was a loan of 300 or 400 grand at the time. It went fine. That one loan itself almost paid for all the money I'd invested in trying to build this relationship in the previous few months, so in the previous 14 months. And since then, this guy has been responsible for raising me over 80 million quid. So absolute peanuts what I spent on him in relative terms. Now, I can only do that because obviously I know my business model, I know the kind of people that I can build relationships with, and I know what I can get out of it if it works. But you all have specific examples of that for your business. So find those people, control the environment, and invest in it. Number four, which says you've seen nothing yet. A lot of the time, if you want to build relationships or get in front of people who you can't normally get in front of, you've got to offer them something that they can't normally get. And again, look, this is all in the context particularly of wealthy people, of successful people. People who've got money can do what they want anyway. So when you're offering them lunch, offering them dinner, unless you already know them anyway, they just don't give a shit. You know, if they want lunch and dinner, they'll go and get lunch and dinner with the people that they want to have lunch and dinner with. But if you've got something that you can offer them, if you've got something that, you know, is outside of their ability to get it, or very much inside their interest level, then this could be a shortcut, could be a hack to be able to get in front of people that you can't normally get in front of. I mentioned earlier that one of my events that I do in the summer is a tennis event with the kind of legends of yesteryear of tennis, you know, previous Wimbledon champions and things. And there's a famous British businessman on the TV who's a big tennis fan, and I wanted to speak to this guy. Didn't have any particular business to do with him, but I just knew that if I could meet this guy, it would be a good relationship to have. Again, that's, you know, general networking, not focused networking, but how can I get in front of this guy? Tried to contact him, obviously not interested to take my call. Then I get my office to reach out to his office to say, would you like to come to Wimbledon to play tennis with me and two previous Wimbledon champions? Because of my network with the tennis, I've got access to, you know, to that kind of thing. And one of my friends from the tennis event, every year he takes me to play on at Wimbledon when the courts have closed after the tournament's finished. All of a sudden, this guy who would never take my call in a million years is straight back on the phone to say, "Well, fuck! Of course I want to play Wimbledon with a couple of Wimbledon champions." Obviously, the catch is he has to do it with me, but he was more than happy to do so. And new, you know, new person in my network. So again, you've got to think outside the box. You've got to find, if you want to get in touch with people, you know, you've kind of got to appreciate the fact that if you want them, then they probably don't want you. So you've got to find a way to make them want you. So that was networking. Now let's talk about relationship building. Sorry? I'm not sure all of them are directly relevant, but they're keeping me entertained anyway. So what the networking that we've talked about up to now, for me, that's meeting the people, you know, whether it's meeting them at events or meeting them online, and that first part of the connection. But if you want to take the, if you want to build these networking to relationships and the relationships to fruition to actually, you know, actually do some business, then you're going to have to get good at building relationships as well as networking. Number one, big relationship building mistake, as my missus will confirm, not devoting enough time to building relationships is a surefire way to not having good relationships. Again, I said, you know, I probably spend 40% of my time networking. That'll be networking, that'll be relationship building. But you've got to invest time in these relationships. Now, there's going to be all kinds of different amounts of time you're going to spend with different people, whether it's a weekly phone call, whether it's an occasional text, whether it's, you know, spending every Sunday with their kids and your kids at the football, whatever it is, only you know that situation. But if you want to build great relationships, you've got to invest time in them. Talking too much, listening too little. I love that old expression of, you know, you've got one mouth and two ears, use them in that proportion. But again, you know, when you're trying to build a relationship with someone, you can't talk too much. Or if you do, not only are you going to piss them off, you're not going to be able to take advantage of listening to everything that they've got to say. So talk less, listen more. Number three, lacking genuine interest. I think this is an important thing to get across in general. That for me, this relationship building, although we're talking about the context of business, whether you're building a relationship in business or whether you're building it for pleasure, it's all the same thing. And whilst ultimately we're trying to build a network to make money from and to further our lives and further our businesses, for me, it's got to be genuine. You know, it's not disingenuous. It's real people that you want to have real relationships with. So you've got to have genuine interest in that person to be able to, you know, to be able to build a relationship with them. And I think if you haven't got genuine interest in them, then maybe it's the wrong person to be building a relationship with. Maybe it's someone, you know, that was on the focus networking list, and you need to be able to build a relationship with them. But then maybe you need to find another way to do it. And they ultimately, if you try hard enough, there's probably always a way to find a connection with someone. You know, maybe the business isn't what you've got in common. Maybe it's sport or kids or some kind of hobby. Massive one, not giving before expecting to receive. You know, the key words of relationship building are give, give, give. And this very much comes into that whole transactional thing, that yes, there'll be the occasional time when there's, you know, when there's somebody who can do some immediate business with. But other than that, you should just be going out there trying to build great relationships with people that will last a lifetime. And some of them, probably most of them, will never transact, but they'll all lead to something else, even if that something else is just having a great time. But you can't build a good relationship by just trying to milk it. You know, you've got to put in before there's something to take out. Not following through on commitments. Again, if you're building a relationship, whether it's for business or for pleasure, if you say something, you've got to do it. If you can't do it, don't say it. You know, there's nothing worse for fucking up a, you know, relationship than talking bullshit. And particularly in today's world, there's obviously so much bullshit out there. And any high caliber person, any credible person can see through bullshit anyway. So don't make the mistake of saying you can do something you can't, or saying you will do something that you won't. Number six, don't be too pushy. Do you like that slide, Wally? No means no. don't be too pushy. Yeah, this ties in with the whole transactional thing. Whether it's trying to transact or whether it's trying to build a relationship, you know, you've got to find that balance of what works between you both, and build the relationship genuinely. If someone's not connecting with you, if someone's not bonding with you, if something's not happening, you know, don't push it. Doesn't mean walk away from it forever. It just means don't push it for now and find a different time at some point in the future. Number seven, neglecting relationships. we were talking about earlier when I said I was kind of coming back from Amsterdam with those 100 cards. If you want, not only have you got to remind the people of yourself in the first place, you've got to nurture those relationships along the way. And you can't meet someone, ignore them for 10 years, and then ring them up for a favour and expect that favour to be to be delivered willingly. So if you're going to build great relationships, you've got to invest in them, you've got to commit to them, you can't neglect them. Again, it's going to be different for different people, whether it's an occasional text message, whether it's a regular phone call, whether it's spending a fortune on them once a month. You'll know for the various situations, but don't neglect them. Number 8, not being transparent. So, as I said, some of these people you'll transact with, most you won't. But if you're going to build a genuine relationship, you've got to be transparent about the situation. And, trying to pretend, if you're dealing with someone who's already successful, someone of a high caliber, if you're being disingenuous, if you're trying to pretend that you don't want something when you do, it will very, very much get seen through. So you need to make sure that your only intention is building a great relationship. That doesn't mean that it's inappropriate to ask for something at some point, but just be honest about it when it is that time. So the 3 most important words in networking tie in with relationship building: give, give, give. If you're going to build great relationships, you have to give. And that doesn't mean give money. It could be giving time, giving support, giving attention and putting something into it so that at some point in the future, there's something to take out of it. If you want to network like a boss, I don't know if anyone has business cards anymore. I certainly don't. But you need a method of connection, method of communication. So you can swap. I'm terrible with it. I'm kind of, so do what I say, not what I do. At the minute, I still just swap numbers on my notes. But I think what really helps from a networking perspective and a memorable perspective is having an up-to-date social media profile and having some kind of online presence. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a massive personal brand, but having something to Google, having something to see on social media will help people remember you, will be that point of interest. That slide is a bit late on. Bonus secrets before we wrap up. I should have said this at the beginning. So if you listen to the end, I will give you a bonus secret of how to connect with absolutely anybody. Have a podcast, and I've only seen a couple of you guys talking here, but I've heard podcasts mentioned with them. I originally met Charlie because I think he'd been on my podcast, I'd been on his podcast. I started a podcast in 2018, I think, 2017, 2018. It was completely by accident. I had some, at the time I was trying to create online content. I had a bit of smelly Google from my troubles back in 2008, and we needed some kind of new content to push down the old content. And I was basically told that if we had some YouTube videos, it'd be good to repurpose some, so I could make a YouTube video, strip out the audio, chop up into Instagram content, Twitter content, etc., and do a lot for a little. So I started a podcast. I then started to find out very quickly that I got to meet great people. I got to meet people that I would never normally have got the chance to meet. I got to have conversations that were kind of fantastically helpful and deep for me. And also, because the content of that podcast was online, it would be a credibility builder, tying in with what we said a minute ago about having an online presence. So when I meet people that I'm trying to build a relationship with, they Google me and see the podcast pop up with various well-known guests. It's a tick in the credibility box for me. And I really, really say to everybody, I can't over recommend having a podcast. I've got a 17-year-old daughter. She's doing her A levels at the minute. She wants to work in engineering, aerospace, that kind of thing, and she's asking me at the moment about how can I connect with this person, or how can I try and get work experience, internships, that kind of thing. And I'm really trying to. She's very shy, so it's a hard push. But I'm very much saying to her, get a podcast. Use it as an excuse to reach out to these people and get them on your podcast to talk about. And I always say with my podcast, I don't give a shit if nobody ever sees it. Yes,
I'm sure from an ego perspective, we all want to be Joe Rogan. But if not one person ever sees or listens to that podcast, what it gives you is that framing to have the chance to meet people that you couldn't normally meet. You know, like I gave that example of the guy where I invited him to play tennis at Wimbledon. So many guests that come on my podcast, they'll be the kind of people where if I ring them up and say, hey, it's Matt here, do you fancy going for a coffee? They'll be calling the police. If my PR ring their PR to say, hey, do you want to come on the Matt Haycock show, you know, with a reach of XYZ, and you can come and talk about whatever it is that you want to talk about and get your message across, all of a sudden it's got completely different framing. It's a give for them as opposed to an ask for me. And it gives me a chance to meet them. Obviously, it's down to me at that point to then apply all the other rules of networking and relationship building to make sure that I build a good relationship with them. But it is just a fantastic way to get in the room with people that you wouldn't normally get in the room with. So I've got a hand wave in the background, which ties in with my Q&A. So listen, that is my talk on networking and my weird and wonderful life over the last 25 years of business. I hope it was good. I hope you could get through my croaky little voice. And if there's anything anyone wants to ask me, whether it's to do with the networking or business, finance, bankruptcy, or just being a cool guy, then fire away.